This is episode 21 of Photo Geek Weekly, recorded on April 5th of 2018. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast where I'm your host, Don Komarechka, and I usually have a guest host to go through all of the geeky topics in the photographic industry that come up on a weekly basis. And this week, I am proud to welcome back the most common guest host on this podcast. And there's good reason, because Alan Attridge is here with me today. And every episode that you've been on, Alan, they have been the most listened to episode. So you're doing something right.
I think it's alphabetical.
Maybe that's it. AA, you are right up at the top. What is new and exciting with you, sir?
Wow. I'm a father of two young kids, so nothing. Nothing's exciting, nothing new in my life.
A wonderful kind of chaos. You know, and I've got a two-year-old here, almost two. And, you know, we're getting into that springtime where she's going to want to be running around in the gardens and having a lot of fun outdoors. And I got to start looking, okay, we got a fish pond that I have to fence in properly, because now that's an issue. You know, trimming back all the rose thorns and the raspberries and everything that she can poke and cut herself on. I don't think I can properly toddler-proof a backyard like ours, but I'm in the efforts of trying right now.
The phrase is the terrible twos.
Yep.
It's a lie. It's a lie. It's three. Three is the hammer. So
that's something to look forward to, I suppose.
That's what we found anyways. Both kids.
Yeah. Well, and she's okay. You know, she gets along well enough with her peers at daycare. And so we're hoping that that continues. And but it's there's never a scenario where there's never been a perfect day with any toddler, I think. I think this is a universal truth. So we just take it as it comes.
She's two now.
Just about. She's two in June.
Two in June. So, okay. So over under on photos that you kept, not the ones that you've taken, but that you've kept. If the over under is at 1,400, I'm taking the over.
I think I'm over that between my wife and I. And we're talking about cell phone snaps, and I've been using the small little Panasonic GX9 as a quick little run and gun camera for her, so that I'm not going out and grabbing the big 1D series camera body and the heavy lenses. And because the moment is gone by the time I've set that all up, unless I'm specifically staging a shot, which I'll do. And, you know, you'll take off 100 photographs of whatever that is. And, you know, as the expressions change from a half second to the next, because it's easy to do that these days. But, you know, the number of images that we've, you know, printed or shared with people, it's nowhere near that, you know, 1400 number. Maybe it's at 100, maybe 200. But it's only the most important memories. And they're often just texted back and forth between my wife and I and family members, and just kind of keeping tabs on things.
My move, and before we move on to the geek stuff, well, this sounds kind of geeky, is I keep a gallery that I just kind of host on Dropbox or something with a private link, and just give it out to my friends and family, and I keep the latest 100 photos on there.
That's a good idea.
So whenever I add a couple, on the back end, I pull a couple off and basically just say, like, you know what, if you missed it, you missed it.
Well, I mean, do you really even have to pull them off? I mean, are you running out of space on Dropbox at that point?
No, it's more so for them, so they don't have to sift through it all.
Right.
And so it kind of forces them to stay current, too, because I've gone on kind of a forget the Facebook rant. But the if they miss that 100 pictures, then it's 100 photos. I don't post everything, but 100 photos will probably get you through 3 to 4 months, probably.
Yeah.
So if you can't log on in that time, you're out. You don't care.
Well, and you know, it's interesting too. There was wireless picture frames, digital picture frames for the longest time. And some of them were able to sync up to an FTP server. And right. I always wanted to do this, although I didn't get around to it and those particular models kind of disappeared. But wouldn't it be cool if I could just throw up a bunch of images on my web server in a specific folder that the picture frame goes and periodically seeks out, and that automatically updates it and refreshes itself and is only rotating the latest and the greatest. My parents have a picture frame sitting on their kitchen table, and there's photos in there that are 10 years old that, well, there's a certain nostalgia from that. I think living a little bit closer to the moment is a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I should look into that again. There's got to be something out there that does that.
I'm sure it exists and has been sold.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's dive into the geekery for the day. And I think we've got some pretty fun stories to talk about here. The first one is a slight paradigm shift from Adobe, rolled out with their latest update of Lightroom Classic CC. And they updated pretty much everything in their suite, by the way. If you are using Premiere, and Alan, we were talking before recording that you're starting to learn Adobe Premiere, they've got some new AI technology that is apparently pretty impressive within that. I haven't had a chance to dig into that yet. But in the photographer realm, they have introduced a massive update, they call it, to the camera profiles feature. And this is something that most people probably wouldn't have used before. It was hidden in the very bottom panel of camera calibration, and it's now moved right up to the top. I would only ever dive into here when I was using my X-Rite color checker passport to create a custom profile for a specific scene. It would show up in this list. Or if I was shooting infrared photography, I would create a custom camera profile for that purpose. But other than that, the Adobe standard was good enough for me. And what this is in this list, you would have always had your camera mode. So from your Canon camera, you would have your Vivid or your Portrait or Landscape, whatever those modes are, they exist as profiles within this. And the Adobe standard was a way to get a similar look across all cameras that Adobe supported. It was quite useful for that. Well, they've completely revamped this feature. And Alan, I know you've read the story, so why don't you pick it up from here and tell me what you think about what they've done?
Well, first off, I think I know the answer, but I can't explain it. What is a camera profile?
So a camera is a raw file or even a JPEG. I mean, these are ones and zeros, and they have to be interpreted in a color space. They have to be interpreted based on color saturation, where shadows and highlights fall. Every camera is going to be slightly different in terms of the intensity of the dyes that are, you know, put in front of the photosites on the sensor that record color information. And so a camera profile will allow that information to be mapped to colors differently. So the in-camera profiles, as I was mentioning, the Vivid and the Landscape, they would map things to be more saturated. Whereas if it was portrait or neutral, they would be less saturated. The portrait one, of course, favoring skin tones to be more naturalized than other colors. So they would be modifying the color characteristics of a photograph on a very basic level, you know, kind of a pre-filter of the information before you even start moving sliders around in Lightroom or any other software.
Now, is that happening in RAW or just in JPEG?
This does not apply in a RAW file. So, for example, monochrome can be a picture style. And so if you want to be shooting monochrome, black and white, you can do that in camera and see a black and white image on the back of your camera screen. So it's in the RAW file, but it only applies to the embedded JPEG file inside the RAW file. Every RAW file has a JPEG inside of it. That's how software like Photo Mechanic can go in and cull photographs so quickly, because it doesn't have to read the full raw data. It just pulls up that embedded JPEG. So in certain cases, it does have an impact on the software that's viewing it. But when you dive into it and you bring up that image in a proper RAW processor, whether it be Canon's Digital Photo Professional, if you're a Canon photographer, or on one, you name it, every processor will do this. It reads the raw data as a secondary step. So the first thing you see is the embedded JPEG that has this predefined picture style or camera profile assigned to it. And then the raw data is read that replaces it based on whatever the default is in, we're talking about Lightroom here. So that default used to be Adobe Standard. And they've changed that as well. They've now changed it to Adobe Color. Not for your previous photographs, but any new imports, it's actually a different, refined, and slightly more saturated version of their universal camera profile that every camera is adapted to.
Okay, and so this much I do understand. Are they basing this on? Because back in the film days, it was okay if you shot Velvia or certain different kinds of film. That would be essentially a film profile.
Yes. So if you look at the examples here, they they kind of feel like that. The samples that have been given, they've got an overarching feel of like, okay, well, this one has a more film effect, or this one looks like it has some built-in split toning. But it's important to know that whenever you select one of these camera profiles, none of the sliders in Lightroom have been adjusted at all, like a preset would.
And that's the confusing part.
Because if you set a preset, it moves all of the sliders around to a predefined position. Whereas choosing a different camera profile in this calibration area, you haven't moved any sliders. It's just giving you a different starting point to move on from.
Right. So I've played around with this a little bit, and you know, so I see the sliders don't move, as you said, but I do see the histogram dance a little bit.
Yep.
Based on which profile. And like yourself, I have not paid much attention in the past to profile. I like to start kind of fresh with just when the raw file comes in. When I do shoot, in certain situations, I will adjust the camera profile in camera, even though I'm shooting raw, just so I have an idea of what the final product will look like, even though it's only in the preview.
Right, and there's a very valuable reason to even set your camera to be a neutral picture style. I mean, we both shoot Canon, so Nikon and other people will call it something other than picture style, but you still have these options. Because the histogram on the back of your camera is not based on the raw data. It's based on the embedded JPEG. And if you use the standard processing, it does a contrast curve to that, and it might show you highlights that are overexposed or shadows that are completely dropped into darkness, whereas the raw file contains more information. The histogram is lying to you a little bit, and so choosing a neutral picture style lets that histogram become a little bit more truthful when you're out in the field.
And I've been on a photo shoot with Tips from the Top for Chris Marquardt, where he likes to show the client the LCD screen as he shoots, something I do not like to do. We differ wildly on that, but he likes to show them as he's shooting. So he takes the contrast and ramps it all the way up to 11, just so that when he shows them the back of the camera, it really pops.
Right.
And now he knows he's not getting that. He's getting the raw file, and he knows what the histogram is going to be anyway. He's shot enough, but they seem to like it.
Well, yeah. And so long as the client is happy and you know that you've got all the material that you have to work with, I think that's great. I wouldn't show, and I don't do portraiture and that sort of stuff, but I wouldn't show the people every photograph. But if I got like the killer shot that requires almost nothing in camera just to get somebody excited about what kind of images are being created, I might show them that one photograph after I've taken it. But that's not to win over the customer. It's only to maybe get them more excited about the next shot and the next one, because you might ask them to do some, you know, silly face or something crazy, and they might think, well, it's not in me right now. But if you give them a taste of what is being created, then they might be more on board. So there's a certain psychology there that I agree with.
Mm-hmm. But so lately I've been shooting the last couple months, I've been shooting with the Fuji X100T. And one of their big selling points is the built-in film. They don't call it profiles. They call it something else, film simulation or something. But essentially, it's a profile. And I didn't even know, this is how uninformed I was, that in Lightroom, if you shoot raw with the X100T, you go into Lightroom, all those film simulation profiles are essentially built in. Even before the update, they were still there.
Right.
And so I had been playing with them for the last month or so, and kind of liked them. I kind of liked the Chrome, for example, the classic Chrome profile. I happen to like it; just looks good to me. And I recently spoke with one of the Fuji ambassadors, a guy named Ian McDonald, who shoots Fuji, and he was explaining to me that a lot of people think that these profiles are essentially Instagram filters. Instagram light.
Yeah,
filters.
And see, that bothers me too, because that is a final step to the process, where this is a first step to the process. And I think that we need to delineate that and to make sure that people appreciate exactly what's trying to be accomplished here. You know, especially if you're trying to color grade images from multiple cameras of the same shoot, like a wedding, for example, choosing similar profiles across multiple cameras, if you can get consistent looks there before you start into any further editing, there's value in that.
Yes, then well, you're talking to a guy who's actually colorblind, so I do my best. And this is actually the hardest part of my post-processing is getting color to match. And so that can be very difficult. So hopefully this will help out. He also said that the Instagram filters were a final step and he was not, you know, promoting him in that way. But in essence, I find that, a lot of these new ones, because they've built in some, like, I forget what they're called now. I went through and looked at
some modern ones, some classic designs. Right. It does feel like Instagram filters because, oh, this one has a purple cast to it. Or, you know, this one
right.
feels like it's an old timey film look that's just for the sake of being that way. And that bugs me a little bit. And I would never be using that. As a starting point for my images, but there is a movement of people mm-hmm. that enjoy that. And so this is a tool for them. However, the underlying functionality of this new calibration or camera profile system gives a lot of power to people that want to create their own. And I did some digging into it's more of a white paper than a tutorial that kind of describes all the technical back-end elements of it. But effectively, there's some complex lookup tables and programming that can be done. Like you can actually write code to generate some of these particular camera profiles that do really interesting things. And so one company that I found that jumped right onto this, and this is published from F-Stoppers, DVLOP, which I think is some sort of weird acronym for develop. I don't know how you would pronounce it. Mm-hmm. But they've released a new Lightroom feature called Leaks and Tweaks. And this uses the new camera profile functionality that's built into Lightroom that creates leaks, light leak effects, and an interesting color gradations that definitely mimic a film feel or what would have otherwise have required you to have a package of overlays like texture overlays and similar things, where these are generated right within Lightroom as a camera profile. And that, to me, is the tip of the iceberg. Because if you can do that on day one with a plugin or a set of features to use that functionality, what can you do a year from now? I mean, how are people, as this becomes more and more populated across, you know, everybody doing their updates and what have you, there's a market for pushing this into some interesting new directions that give you a jumpstart on where you want to take a photo creatively without having to to do that at the end, but doing it at the beginning.
And then, but once you do dial in this, you know, say Modern 3 or whatever, the names need some better names. I'll be honest with you. But once you dial that in, you can then hit the sliders and adjust.
Exactly. It's not like you have to start here. You can dial it back a little bit if it's too much.
That's one of the things I actually liked is right below it. It has I guess it starts at 100 and you can go to 0 or 200. Right? Is that
I think that's how it works. Yeah.
That's the amount. So you can basically dial it right back down and, you know, so just kind of season it a little bit and then also make other adjustments. But the one real positive, the one thing, I found most of this to be clutter. Yeah. I mean, I do use a couple of them.
There's too much.
There's way too many. I figured out after a little bit of messing around with it that you can actually save your favorites and they'll pop up in the drop-down menu. So I recommend doing that rather than sift through, you know, all 300 of them or whatever comes standard. It's less than that.
But it does scroll across the entire panel. Like it fills it all the way up. And it's kind of useless, to be honest with you. I'd say three or four of them might find a use for me, maybe in rare scenarios. But it's just like when you would go through Photomatics or any other program that has a bunch of starting points, you know, where all the sliders are in different positions. There is 50 of them in a lot of these programs. Yeah. And it's overwhelming to me in most cases because it's like analysis paralysis. It's, well, which one do I choose? And I don't like that either.
Yeah, if you go to a wedding and they say, do you want the steak or the fish? You have an answer really quickly. If there's 50 choices, you're going
to
be there.
And I'm
going
to be a little bit hesitant to order any of them that are a little bit more exotic, because how often do they actually cook that?
Yeah, I only order fish on the coast. That's a true story. For real. Even in Germany, don't eat the fish. The one, I looked for a positive, and the one positive thing that I really liked about this is that if you just mouse over one of the options, you will see an instant preview of that.
Yeah, and that means they've got to be kind of pre-calculating that stuff in the background so that it would pop up very, very fast. There's no wait time, no lag. And they did it right there. And kudos mm-hmm. to Adobe for that.
So I have saved like two of my favorite Fuji presets, the Velvia and the Classic Chrome, whether I use them or not, because it's the kind of thing that if you know what you're doing with the sliders, you can dial in things to look pretty similar.
Yep. Or you can just go out and buy some Velvia film if you want to, right?
You could do that. So recommend that. Yeah. So overall, this is the other good news is this isn't, if you don't want it to be obtrusive, it's not.
Yeah, you might not even notice it unless you were looking for it. They did move it up to the top. And, as an aside, they also put the dehaze slider right next to the clarity slider in the basic panel, because it made no sense to have it way down in effects next to film grain when it was something that was much more rudimentary, useful as a starting point to edit an image with. And so, good for them figuring out where that slider goes. But it's this, aside from this camera profile thing, which has legs when people, start to run with it, this update to Lightroom really didn't impress me that much. I mean, a couple new cameras and lenses are supported. That's great. My GX9, I can now read the RAW files from that. So woohoo there. But it just seems like a step to make people happy and to keep people subscribed. And that's what Adobe's been doing a lot lately. And I'm not happy. I've said that before. I'm actively looking at other software platforms to replace Lightroom, so long as it can do all of the subtle niche things that I need, like sending multiple photos to Photoshop as layers and to allow me to properly process my infrared images and what have you. So as soon as somebody else has that, then I might just leave this one behind.
I literally just signed up, renewed my 1-year subscription. So let's hope it's going to be great.
Let's hope it'll be a great year. Yeah.
And that's for the whole suite, because I'm as you mentioned earlier, I am making the transition over to Premiere, and I do like the way everything plays together.
And if you are the full Creative Suite, they don't call it the Master Collection anymore, but your price is going up too. I'm not sure if you saw that, but from $50 mm-hmm. US a month, I think it's going up to $58 US a month.
Right.
Yeah. So there you go.
So that's going right to the clients.
Fair enough. Hey, let's move on to the next story, which is kind of a two-parter. Some new sensor technology from Canon. And the first part was kind of interesting, is a 100 frames per second ultra low light sensor. So if you want to basically see in the dark, there's been cameras that have been able to do that for quite some time, but none of them that could do it at a very fast frame rate. So they have just pushed the envelope here a little bit farther to say, oh, all right, if you want to do full HD video, you can do that in almost no light whatsoever and do it at 100 frames per second and play that back in semi-slow motion for some really interesting effects. You see people walking very smoothly and slowly. Water and waterfalls in their demo video looked really good. What I would love to see from tech like this is from a documentary filmmaker type of standpoint, like having a fox or a wildcat or any type of predator just pouncing on prey in the middle of the night, and just to have that wonderful dynamic action played out in slow motion, which this kind of technology now allows for. It's not going to be a camera that you or I run out to buy, Alan, but what do you think about where these limits are being pushed today?
Well, that's the fantastic part, because, well, as you said, I'm never going to own this. This is first of all, I don't have a very good track record of predicting the future of tech. I don't see the road ahead of me. I missed YouTube coming, and not that I was going to invent YouTube, but I had a different side project that would have really worked well with YouTube. And then YouTube overtook it. But anyways, so I could be way off here. I don't understand the market for this. Because as you said, I mean, it would be fantastic to watch, you know, vipers attack whatever they attack. I'm not a hepatologist, but whatever they attack at night. But that's going to happen 3 or 4 times, and certainly that won't pay for the R&D on this tech.
Right. So this kind of comes into a realm of who paid for this, right? Who is behind the scenes footing the bill for this for whatever specific project? And it might have military applications. And so there could be some contracts about that, you know, I can see there being military uses for slowing down things to check out ballistic paths at night or to see certain movements of equipment, or I don't know. There's a purpose there.
But slowing it down, now the article I read said it was 100 frames per second.
Yeah.
Nothing to sneeze at, but not setting any records for slow motion.
Not at all, but at this level of light, you know, and I think I mentioned before, we tried to do slow motion when I was doing filming for the Discovery Channel mosquito documentary. And we were using a really high-speed Phantom camera, but it needed so much light in order to operate at those high speeds. So much right. So that at the higher speed settings, if we turn the lights on at the required intensity onto a mosquito that we wanted to capture its, you know, taking off and its wings fluttering, we would kill the mosquito. It would die right. from the intensity of the light and the heat before we were getting the footage that we wanted to illustrate how their flight patterns worked for the documentary. So to do this with lower light or almost no light, ambient light, maybe it can function in the light of the full moon. It seems like it could by the footage that I was seeing. So there is a market for it. But again, how many are they going to sell? Like worldwide, maybe 100? I can't see this being a huge market.
Well, I see it being a huge market in security cam footage.
But for example, does security camera footage need to be 100 frames per second?
But that becomes the issue when, well, maybe it does. I mean, not to slow it down, but just for added clarity when you are playing it back. If you play it back at 100 frames per second, it looks normal, like in terms of speed, doesn't slow down, but those in between frames are all there. So I don't know if perhaps that is, I don't think it is. I'm trying to look for a market for this camera, but that's the best I can come up with.
Well, I think low light nature is going to be the only footage from this camera that you will personally be seeing. And it will be wrapped into some, you know, high production value documentary films. And this is the kind of camera that I think certain outfits will buy to rent, right? You'll be able to rent the camera for a week if you need it for a particular shoot, and you wouldn't be paying outright for the entire camera. It's not something you always are going to need in your camera bag. But the fact is that that they're pushing this out above and beyond what low light cameras they had a couple of years ago. I think they started to push into this market, and now, you know, we have this. So what comes next? Who knows? But Canon is really reinventing things with sensors. I think it was a year or two ago, we heard about a prototype 120 megapixel sensor, and that is coming closer and closer closer to being an actual product. So also in the news this week, this is an APS-H sized camera sensor, which is a bit of a misnomer, but I'll get into that in a little bit. That is now being showed off with actual footage, and the resolution is 13,280 by 9,184. That's about 60 times the resolution of full HD video. And the magic here is that it can shoot at a ridiculous 9.4 frames per second, which, wow, at that resolution, I don't even know if any storage medium could keep up with that.
So that's essentially stills. I thought that was, they were advertising that as a video camera.
Well, I mean, sure, it's kind of advertised as both, but I think that this has a market. 9.4 frames per second is not video quality for any commercial purposes for production value. But machine vision might be something where you've got an assembly line of parts going by and you need high resolution imagery to spot defects or failures. This could find its way into an industrial camera of some sorts where that's a real requirement. But the reason why Canon started using this sensor size that's right in between the Rebel and the 7D size and the full frame, so that's the 1D, 5D, 6D size, was because they couldn't get a full frame camera sensor at a high resolution to shoot at a fast enough frame rate. And so this is probably the reason why they've chosen to bring back the APS-H sensor size, which the last time it was used in a production body was the 1D Mark IV, I believe. And and that was because they needed that frame rate for the sport shooters on that particular camera body. And now they're able to get that throughput by just narrowing the sensor size down a little bit and coming up with something that that can push those electrons through, those ones and zeros. But again, I'm left wondering, okay, well, this would be great to have in my next camera body. Do I need 120 megapixels? I'm happy right now with 20. You know, and the 5DS and 5DSR, whatever the successor to that is, might be 50 megapixels. It might be a little bit more. I doubt it'll be 120. So who needs this kind of resolution?
You're asking the wrong guy, because I certainly don't. when you first sent this, they talked about, they gave it in terms of it's so many times larger than a standard HD, full HD image. So I thought they were essentially shooting for video. But in that idea, like just that analogy, how many megapixels, how much resolution does your television at home need?
Oh, I mean, 4K is a very small fraction of this as well. And when we get up to 8K, well, this is, I think, 13 point something K, you know, if you were to put that in proper video terms, which is well beyond the next gen of what we're going to be doing in terms of display technology. So if you want to super future-proof the footage that you record, but at that point, the human eye can't even see a difference, and it would be a marketing term. Yeah.
Exactly. But do you have a 4K TV?
I've got a 4K monitor that's in front of me. It's a 32-inch display, and we use it as a TV quite often. So, you know, technically, yes. But, you know, we're sitting a great distance away. There's a couch behind me. And that's where we're sitting, and we'll watch a show in the evening or whatever. And if it was half the resolution at that distance, we wouldn't tell the difference at all. In fact, we're streaming Netflix, which is not streaming in 4K because we're not paying for that higher package.
Right. I mean, not yet. It might come out. I understand we want to keep going and going and going. I myself, I'm the guy who I stopped at 32 inches for my TV. That was great. It's full HD, 1080p, doesn't need to be 4K. At that size, you will never tell the difference.
Yep.
It's not going to happen. So I'm all set. I'm not worried about that. Again, for this specific product, I see it again more the practical application in security things, crowd shots, stuff like that. Because they showed, one of the examples they showed was crowd shots.
Yeah, if you want to do facial recognition of everybody in a crowd at like a presidential inauguration, because, you know, somebody in that crowd is, you know, a convicted felon or whatever, and you want to make sure that everybody stays safe. Absolutely. That's actually, I didn't even think of that. And you could be just constantly shooting at that 9.4 frames per second and get all the data that you'd need for that security purpose.
I could see this being in every airport.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at every entrance, you know, for whatever they're screening over the crowds, even the people that haven't even checked in yet, just to see who's mulling about and could possibly cause some issues. Or sporting stadiums. You know, we've had a lot of bomb issues and terrorist actions around large crowds of people. And a camera like this for facial recognition and whatever the next gen artificial intelligence for reading and understanding that data, that's actually a very valid use case that I hadn't properly considered before. But if you were thinking photographically, there's a big issue here, especially based on that sensor size. Diffraction is going to blur the heck out of everything unless you're shooting at f2.8 or wider. So your example of crowds works because that's closer to infinity focus, and you'll have much of everything in focus at that point. But with the pixel size, the individual photo sites on the sensor being so small, if you have a useful aperture today, it's going to limit the resolution of this sensor to much lower than that 120 megapixels that that it's capable of. So diffraction, huge issue for practical use of a sensor this size.
Not the physical size, but the 120 megapixel size.
Right, because if you put 120 million pixels onto a sensor that is about 29 by 20 millimeters or so, the individual pixels are so tiny, butted up all next to each other, that light, when it passes through an aperture, will bend off course a little bit. And the smaller the aperture, right, the more that light will bend off course. Just like if you have a dike and you've got straight waves hitting against it, and you have curved waves on the other end when it kind of bends around the opening. The same thing happens with light because it's the same wave nature. Light will bend around the opening of the aperture and spread itself out, and that's diffraction. It will be hitting the pixel next to the one that it should be hitting. And, you know, some of the light from that pixel will be hitting into its neighbors and so on and so forth, effectively blurring the images.
So unsharp mask and we're good.
I don't think it's quite that easy. Although if you could detect the exact trajectory of light, not just, collecting the light itself, but on a per photon basis, and do so from two slightly different neighboring points, maybe you shift the sensor a little bit one way to the other, you might be able to computationally remove diffraction, although I haven't actually found anybody that that has done that. Anyhow.
Well, Chris Marquardt and I invented that 7 years ago. It's called directional desensitization.
Oh, lovely.
We caught a lot of flack for that. That was the April Fool's joke from 7 years
ago. I remember the invisible camera. And I own the resulting product from that, the International Pinhole, the Marquardt International Pinhole.
That was the inspiration for that entire thing.
I have serial number one of that particular camera, and I'm very happy to have it. So one final thing that just sticks in my craw a little bit here is the definition of these sizes. So just to dial back to 1996, APS stands for Advanced Photo System. Kodak was famous with their Advantix film in this particular format. And this was designed as a smaller type of film that was, you know, brain dead simple to load into a camera and use. And it was a modern film version. It had a...
It was the cartridges.
Yeah, exactly. And right. So they had three different standards, H for high definition, C for classic, and P for panoramic. But the C and the P were just a cropped in version of H, right? The film was always the same size, but it would just, you know, format things a little bit differently on the upcoming prints. APS-H, the original definition is 30.2 by 16.7 millimeters. That's a 16:9 aspect ratio, which would make a 4:7 print. That is nowhere near the dimensions of an APS-H digital sensor, which is supposed to be based on the exact same size. Otherwise, why the hell would you even call it that? So It's 29.22 times 20.20 millimeters in the Canon world. And that has always bugged me. So I'll get off my soapbox. All right. That kind of puts a pin in that particular story. But it's fun to see the new sensor tech that's coming out, even if it hasn't found a home yet. This will trickle down, or at least some of the underlying technology that's built into the miniaturization of these photo sites, and the speed that can be run through a sensor and have it processed in a timely manner, that will end up in our consumer products. They've got patents up the wazoo in order to make it happen on these industrial scales. So we'll see that in some way, shape, or form on future cameras that we all buy.
That's what I'm looking forward to most, is them being able to offload at a much lower resolution even, but being able to offload that and get essentially the what I've always missing. And I know they exist, but they're on expensive cameras like the Alexa or something like that. But the global shutter,
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for, to get rid of the whole Jello effect, the rolling shutter.
I think Panasonic showed a prototype of a global shutter sensor recently as well. And I didn't know Panasonic was necessarily in the sensor business at all. So it's great that they've got a patent portfolio, or they've licensed enough to produce a product that is shaking things up again. And that paradigm shift, I think once that's established as a mass-produced product on a greater scale than those really high-end cinema cameras, then we'll see it everywhere. And we'll see it at the flagship camera from every big manufacturer, and that will trickle down from there too. So I'd say within the next 10 years, we will have global shutters. We will have more resolution than we could actually ever use, and memory card speeds that are 10 times faster than we currently have. That those specs are actually being developed right now. So yeah, it's a fun time.
Global shutter in your smartphone?
Why not? Exactly. You know, it's especially when you're miniaturizing things and mass producing them to that level, you do it once and you put it into the next iPhone or Samsung Galaxy and you're golden. Yeah, cool. All right, the final story, and you kind of were trying to lead a bit of a segue into that.
We should have a eye contact on that one.
Exactly. This is interesting. So I don't use my cell phone for anything more than that immediate quick snapshot of my daughter running across the living room or playing with something cute, or, you know, we've got that quick moment where we see something interesting on the street, or to photograph the price tag at the grocery store of something to text to my wife. I mean, this is what I use a cell phone camera for. But I'm using an old iPhone 6 right now. It doesn't have the optical quality.
Old iPhone 6.
I know. It's antiquated by the latest and greatest. So I wouldn't be using it for anything professional. But if you go to the flagship smartphones today, their cameras are very usable for production work if you wanted to do so. So would you take it a step farther, Alan, and start putting attachments on that? We've had lens attachments for many years. Would you put square filters on your smartphone?
Okay, I don't have a phone, so no. I'll show you the picture of my phone. It's right over there. It has a dial on it. That's a true story. So I don't want to be. I'm wondering, am I just being Captain Negative? I don't know. I'm not feeling this one. The square filters on the smartphone.
Yeah, Nisi Pro Series, or Pro Sories, I'm not sure exactly, maybe that's a typo. P1 kit from DP Review is where we're finding this information. And the kit for $40, I mean, it's not an expensive add-on. So it is something that you can throw under the Christmas tree, or make it a stocking stuffer to somebody you know that likes photography, has a nice phone, and might make a nice gift idea, I suppose. But how practical would it be to put a graduated ND filter on a smartphone? And it can move up and down and it can rotate. A polarizing filter might have some potential usefulness depending on what you're trying to do. If you're a street photographer using your smartphone as the primary camera, then there could be some uses there. But I think the whole point of taking a picture with a smartphone is because it fits in your pocket. You don't have to be carrying anything else around you to take your pictures, and everything that you need to make your image is either built into that camera or it's an app that lets you edit the photo afterwards, but you're not adding things onto it. There's a huge market for this stuff, though, and it continues to sell like crazy. I just don't know who's buying it.
That was the surprise to me. I said, I do get the appeal of it, because every 13 days we see a new feature article on some blog sort of touting this magazine cover for Fortune 500 was shot entirely on an iPhone. Or this, I think Steven Soderbergh shot his latest film entirely on an iPhone. For real.
Yeah, well, okay. I got to say, though, entirely on an iPhone, dial it back from the phone and see the rig and all the attachments and the crew and the lighting and everything beyond that. It is the engine of the vehicle, but it is not the sole instrument.
That is 100% accurate. There is more to the story. However, it comes up, but even though it comes up every 13 days or so,
you've timed this because you've mentioned 13 days twice now. So this is something.
Well, I wrote it down in my notes.
Right.
That's the median time. But those are actually, in the grand macro view of everything, that is a very, those are rare examples. People aren't, Annie Leibovitz isn't shooting on an iPhone.
No. No, and
probably not.
But then you see these articles on Petapixel or wherever else where it's like, okay, you know, do great portraiture with a $10 lamp from IKEA and your smartphone. And you know what? The photos that they show, they're pretty darn good.
They are good. So I do see it. That's where I'm trying not to be Mr. Negative. I do see, like, I see the appeal of the smartphone photographer. If I was a smartphone guy, I would shoot with it all the time. I'm not snobbing at all. I love it. To me, it is exactly what you said, though. It's the simplicity of it all. It takes everything else out. Now you're adding this filter adapter, and then you have to carry the filters, I'm assuming, and you have to mess around. Like, the simplicity is gone.
Right, and so the filters have to be probably in some sort of protective pouch because you don't want to get them full of fingerprints and grime and dust and what have you. So now you've got a pouch that's probably, hopefully, holding this little clip thing and all the filters. So then you've got a little carrying case for that that has to go where? That's too big to fit in your pocket, so that's got to be in a purse or in what, a camera bag? You're going to bring a camera bag along? Well, you might as well bring a real camera along at that point.
Yes. I don't see soccer moms buying these. As you mentioned, most of what you want to do can be replicated in post. Almost everything. Reflections are going to be tough, so maybe you want the polarizer, as you mentioned. Like, that would come in handy. But in terms of, I want to make the sky blue and the clouds pop, you can kind of get most of the way there in post.
Yeah, or you can use a software application that will shoot multiple exposures, you know, HDR it, and then you can do a graduated ND filter in post, which is what I've done. I've never owned a graduated ND, because if I can do that after the fact and refine it and fine tune it and choose exactly how it's going to be applied to the image because the camera doesn't have the necessary dynamic range, well, that is by far better than hoping you get it right in camera and having no ability to change it afterwards.
The only time I could see you wanting an actual ND put on there is basically you're going to shoot a waterfall. You want that slow shutter speed.
Well, sure, but that would be a full ND and not a graduated one. And
no, not a graduated one. But in terms of not doing it in post versus doing it, like, you want to be able to slow that water down. You got to slow that shutter speed down in your iPhone. What I would do is I would probably just snap that shot through my sunglasses and move on with my day.
Pretty much. Your sunglasses are polarized. That's the best solution right there. I love it. But to be fair, actually, and I don't know if an app does this, but I'm surprised if there isn't something. A lot of the newer phones will shoot 4K video. And if you can shoot 4K video at a decent frame rate, then you can combine all of those frames together to get a pseudo blur effect like you would get from an ND filter without ever having to have one handy.
Mm-hmm. No, you can.
Well, sure. You have to have the knowledge to understand that, and that's how it can be done, and either in camera with an app or in post-processing with specific software. But technology and our understanding and our ability to use it shouldn't be a barrier to creativity. You shouldn't need to have something like this to say, okay, well, I need this because I need to get rid of reflections. Like you said, your sunglasses, you know, that same tech is on your head right now. You don't need a separate pouch as a fanny pack to carry that along for just your smartphone.
Yeah. Verdict, it kills the simplicity of the phone. I'm not buying either.
Yeah. Same here. All right. Final section that is not exactly scripted, but we've got ideas already in the can for the picks of the week. And Alan, you haven't even told me what yours is, so I'm very curious as to what you've got in mind.
Well, you hinted that you picked a book.
I did.
So I also picked a favorite book of mine.
And?
One Fish, Two Fish. No, I didn't pick that one. I picked, there's a I don't know if he's a famous photographer or not. He's famous in Vancouver. A guy named Fred Herzog.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that name before.
Okay, he's very, very famous in Vancouver. Should be worldwide. I mean, is worldwide. He's a street photographer who's shot, boy, when did he even, like, now I'm on the spot of when he shot. I've read his biography part of the book too, and kind of came up in the, came over after the end of the World War II from Germany, hence you can tell by the name, but and started shooting street photography before it was a thing, sort of in the 50s and in the 60s. I believe he was a medical photographer, but also shot out on the street. And his pictures, specifically of Vancouver, are amazing because he shot color.
Well, and in that era, that was expensive and few people would, right?
And it was also kind of snubbed. The galleries, I believe at the time, were just not interested. They were very snobby. And it was all about, no, black and white is the true medium. You don't shoot color. But he was shooting slide film. And now, so he has a number of books, but one that I have, one that I recommend, is called Modern Color by Fred Herzog. And it is amazing. Just going through and like, I wonder if at the time, I can see that at the time his pictures are not being appreciated. And they have to sort of, because they're kind of a fine wine. And that they're getting aging wonderfully.
And to make a photo that is timeless and actually gets better with time instead of feeling antiquated and outdated, that is a mark of a true photographer.
Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, see, I didn't know this. I knew who Fred Herzog was, and I'm from Vancouver, but currently now living near Stuttgart, Germany. And he's actually, I find out he was born and raised in Stuttgart. So that, there's that connection. So he is, small I believe world. He's still alive. He's probably in his 90s.
Wow.
So I'd love a chance to meet the guy one time. But check out his book, Modern Color by Fred Herzog.
Now, in the book, does it talk about his techniques, how you can achieve the same stuff? Does it go over his process and his journey? Or is it just an educational book?
It's not it's barely educational.
Oh, good.
it's a coffee. No. It's, well, that's not true. I mean, it's educational to the right person. It doesn't go through. It's not a how-to book. It's a coffee table book.
Right.
But the images are amazing, and there are a lot of them. And they talk about his history and whatnot, and a little bit about his process, but they don't go too far into that. It's more about the images themselves.
Right.
And
I've got a number of books like that from some famous photographers as well. And another Canadian photographer, Boris Spremo, who's known, he passed away recently within the last year, I think. But he is a world-renowned photojournalist, and he's covered world leaders and wars and celebrities and everything of note. And his book is predominantly photos as well, but you flip through that and you just can't help but play the stories out in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not the book that I'm choosing, by the way. Although it is a good one. I have here a book that I read a while ago and I'm just currently rereading it. It's called Dialogue with Photography. And these are a bunch of interviews done in the mid to late 70s. And the original publication was made in 1979 of a series of photographers asking them questions about their work, about their life, about what inspired them and what pushed them forward, what allowed them to be the artists that they became. There's almost no pictures in this book. It's all text. It's all interviews. But it is really good. It has aged well. I was flipping through the interview with Paul Strand, but there's also, names that I might, Brassai, Henri Cartier-Bresson, tons, there's about a dozen or so people in this book. But I was reading the Paul Strand one, because he's the first one in the book, and he was asked a question how would you define documentary photography or filmmaking? And a line in here really stuck out to me the first time I read it, and I came back to it here as well. He said that I'm attracted to those who are more interested in everything that exists outside of themselves. That's the final source for all of the best art, and it's a source which has hardly been tapped. And that's true today as it was in 1974 when he was interviewed from that. So while this book is old, the insight and the commentary is really, really valuable. I picked the book up for $1 at a used bookstore. So I'm sure you could find it on Amazon. I don't know if it's still in print, but there was revisions that have additional interviews in it after the first print. So take a look for Dialogue with Photography. Paul Hill and Thomas Cooper are the joint authors on that one.
So I love books about craft like that. There's a book I read, a number of years ago by Walter Murch, very famous editor and sound editor, where he talks about not specifically the, oh, here's the cuts, or here's why I do this, or here's how I do this. He does talk about here's why, and how it makes you feel, and how that transition goes into the actual cuts and the sound design of certain movies. And it is, wow, it is invaluable.
Yeah, and there's a lot of inside baseball in this book about how photography became art, and how galleries started to attract photography, and how it was almost a shunned topic in certain circles, but then embraced in others because it was an emerging art form. Some people had absolutely zero respect for it, and other people were giving it a chance. And so you see these people that were interviewed in exactly that era when they were coming up as photographers. And we're talking about, you know, the era surrounding World War One into World War Two. I mean, this was a very pivotal era in terms of photography, because it was used for so many things. And the book adventures and goes through all of these different journeys amongst photographers that lived through those times and made art. And made very beautiful artwork. And what challenges did they have to face? Well, they're probably not going to be the same challenges that we face today. But I think that it still survives on as understanding that everybody who is an artist faces unique challenges that nobody else around them will be facing.
All right. I'm going to look for that down at Das Buchladen tomorrow. We'll see if it's here in Germany.
All right. Good luck with that.
In English.
In English, yeah. You'll want that for sure. I know you do, you do the German, but there's a lot of big words in this book. Yeah. So, Alan, as we finalize this episode, as we wrap it all up, you know, spring is in the air for me. And as I mentioned, I'm doing gardening, and I've got some new series of images that I'm moving on to now that my snowflake stuff is all wrapped up. Thank goodness. What's the next big project for you?
Next big project. It's my two kids and baseball. It's baseball season now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, you're doing, of course, outside baseball. What are the temperatures like in Germany at this time of the year?
We're looking at opening day. Well, opening day tournament is this weekend on Saturday, and so we're looking at like 20 degrees.
Oh my god,
that's a massive spike. We had snow last week. We had a preseason tournament. We got snowed out of at minus 10. So this is just kind of happening at the right time. And it can snow at the end of April here, so let's not get too excited.
Right. We got the snowdrops and the crocuses that are poking up through the snow because we just got dumped on again. And we got temperatures over the next couple of days going down to -7, -8 degrees Celsius. So still got some wood next to the wood stove stoked up. And we will enjoy that final blast of winter as we finish up our polar vortex that we're enjoying.
Which, on the plus side, if I can plus side you for a second, no mosquitoes.
You know what? That is a wonderful plus. I saw my first house fly for the season the other day, and I was a little bit dismayed because I know there will be many more. But yeah, the insects have not come to life. However, my next series of images is going to be relying pretty heavily on insect life as a little teaser for that. I need to add actors into my macro work, and these will be predominantly staged images. Like, was it 2 years ago now? I wrangled an ant to walk along a blade of grass that I had set up with a flower in the background to refract water droplets on that blade of grass. And the ant stands in the perfect pose overlooking these blades of grass. It's my cover image on my Facebook page if anybody wants to take a look at it there. That took an entire day and many, many takes because an ant is an uncooperative subject.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's nothing you can do with an ant to gain any trust or confidence. They're just, you know, if you poke them the wrong way, then they start, you know, spazzing out because, you know, there's some intruder or what have you. So I would carefully take it with a twig, poke it on the peonies that were just about to bloom, and the ants were all swarming over these peonies, and then move that stick to the blade of grass that I wanted. And the ant is none the wiser that anything unusual has happened and just continues to explore, and was able to get the shot after about 6 hours of trying. So that sort of thing is in my future again, to try and, you know, combine the natural world with I don't want to say artificial sets because it's all natural ingredients, but definitely mm-hmm. constructed by me as the photographer.
Wow. That sounds intense.
Yep. So more of that for me. And I want to try and introduce with that same idea, the ultraviolet fluorescent stuff that I've been doing lately. So I've been collecting some minerals and some flowers that I know fluoresce quite beautifully. And if I can create that same image that seems to be glowing from within, then I think I got a real winner there. So I've got a lot of failure in that process. I know I will make, I don't know, a dozen mistakes and failures before I end up getting anything useful. So you might not even see any of those images until midsummer, but I'll keep at it.
We look forward to that, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So Alan, where can people find you online?
My own site is alanattridge.com. Or you can find my podcast, The Two Hosers Photo Show, at twohosers.com.
Twohosers.com. And Alan with two L's and two A's, and Attridge with two T's.
Yes. You know it better than I do.
We'll have the links in the show notes because there are too many ways to spell Alan. But thank you so much for being here. And those show notes will be found at photogeekweekly.com, where we have this wonderful podcast, and Inside the Lens, which will be coming back to life very soon, which is our expert deep dive onto a specific topic. So look for that in the next little while. I can be found at doncom.ca. donkom.ca if you want to see a portfolio of my work, or get in touch with me, send me an email. All of my social media links are there as well. So as we wrap this episode up, I should probably say you should get out and shoot.